listening to Writer's Voices. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson, your host today. With me, I have a fabulous guest. We're going to have a great show. Kate McGinnis is our guest. She studied writing at the University of Southern California under the tutelage of Janet Fitch, who authored the Oprah Book Club selection, White Oleander. Kate pursued further studies in creative writing at the University of California, Los Angeles. Previously, she'd earned a Juris Doctor degree to become an attorney, and that was from the University of San Diego. She practiced for quite a while before leaving the corporate world to tackle fiction writing. She practiced law for 17 years at a major international law firm, where she was one of a handful of women to achieve coveted partnership status. Later, a Fortune 500 company recruited Kate to serve as its general counsel. Today, she's a full-time writer who advocates for women's rights. Her essays on women's issues have appeared in Forbes Woman, the Women's Media Center, Jezebel, Role Reboot, Ms. J.D., The Girl's Guide to Law School, and Femme 2.0. Her first published novel, Terminal Ambition, a legal thriller that explores issues of sexual harassment and discrimination, was published by Kate's publishing company, 2X Press, in 2012. Welcome to the show, Kate.
Thank you very much. It's a delight to be interviewed by a woman who's also been through the law school process.
I really enjoyed law school, and one of the things that I felt was some of the skills that I learned as a law school student and later as an attorney writing briefs in the company that I worked for was some of those skills transferred over to fiction writing. And I've read that you feel that you had to learn some completely new skills when you turned from practicing law to becoming a fiction writer. So what were some of the things you had to do?
Well, one of the things that I had to do was to loosen up my words. I used to, most of the writing I did was 100-page long single-space documents, and often they were negotiating multi-million and in several cases multi-billion dollar agreements. And as you know, in that context, every word is so carefully chosen. And you lose some fluidity for clarity. There's a trade-off. So that was one of the things that I had to work on, was loosening up the words. Also, you don't want, in the context of corporate documents, you don't want emotion to leak in there. I imagine you do in writing briefs, or at least you're trying to create emotion on behalf of the readers. But for me, learning to convey emotion in my writing in more subtle ways than saying she was sad. That was a challenge. And, of course, learning how to write dialogue. So, as you probably know, dialogue really isn't a transcription of a conversation, because that would be quite boring. But learning how to write dialogue in a way that has a sense of being genuine, and each character has his or her own voice. I mean, I found writing very challenging, but I love it.
Yeah, there's different skills, but there are also, do you feel there are also some skills that are common to both the practice of law and the practice of being a novelist?
Well, first one that comes to mind is discipline and determination and being willing to keep soldiering through, even in the face of obstacles and in the face of temptations to go out in the other room and watch a football game, or you have to, keeping at it as a novelist is, I think, very important. I had a writing instructor that recommended that when you finish the first draft of your novel, and oh, that's such a huge accomplishment, and his recommendation was, then throw it away and start again.
Wow, I've never heard that advice. Yeah. I mean, you do hear people saying the first novel is a throwaway, and it's where you're learning things. But this isn't the first novel you've written.
No, I have written other novels, but I have to tell you, the storyline, the basic premise of having a legal thriller that features a female protagonist fighting against sexism in a major law firm, that thread has been there since 1997. And it's been reincarnated many times. I consider my first version of this, which was called, I think, Remaining Silent, that was the Neanderthal ancestor of this.
Interesting. So was there a particular political event or something that you heard about that caused you to be ready to write this story in 1997?
Well, in 1997, I left the corporate world, and I had seen over my career a number of women that, regardless of how humble or prestigious their positions were subject to sexual harassment and discrimination. And some women were able to shrug it off, but I have also seen women driven to the brink of considering suicide because of this. So it was an issue that haunted me, having seen it so many times. And I have to admit, I'm a second-wave feminist, and that rhetoric stayed with me.
So when did you first feel the impulse to start writing fiction? Was it in 1997, or did you early on, before you went to law school, think, oh, I'd like to be a writer, but, you know, who makes a living doing that? And what was your career path?
Oh, I had a pretty crooked career path, I have to say. I started undergraduate school thinking that I wanted to be an actor. And I suppose that is related to writing, because you have to imagine different character states of mind. How does this person feel? And what's the emotional response
of the
other?
Seems to me it also relates to practicing law. If you're a trial attorney, you have to be, you know, able to convey a story and convince the jury or the judge to believe your side of the story. And, you know, you do have to have some elements of acting.
Well, absolutely. And I thought when I got out of law school, I was absolutely sure I was going to become a trial lawyer. I had, after my second year in law school, had a clerkship with the city attorney's office in San Diego. And they split your summer. Half was in civil, writing memos, but the other half was in criminal. And I actually got to make a lot of trial appearances. I prosecuted a drunk driving. I prosecuted a petty theft. And I just thought that was chocolate sauce, and that was what I was going to do. But I went to
specifically be a prosecutor, you thought?
No, I thought I wanted to be a lawyer in a big firm, you know, handle big matters, because the experience I did have showed me how jaded the prosecutors got. It became like a factory. And the single experience, if there was one that convinced me I didn't want to be a prosecutor, was I had won this drunk driving conviction, and it was a man who had been convicted before, and he had no insurance. And so I was still in the internship program when he came up for sentencing. And my mentor attorney supervisor said, well, you can go argue what you want for sentence, but, you know, understand this judge never sends anyone to jail. And I went in and made an impassioned plea about this was a repeat offender, no insurance, he should be sent to jail. And the judge sentenced him to jail. But when he walked away in leg irons and handcuffs, I had certainly a moment of concern about whether I'd been a little overzealous.
It's hard to know what's the right thing.
It is.
Yeah. That's interesting, because I was on the other side at my law school. I went to the University of Washington School of Law in Seattle. We only had one clinical program, and it was criminal. Yeah. So I was on the other side. I was a public defender while I was in law school, so I got to make, we each had like 10 clients. They had to be misdemeanors. We didn't get felons. But I did have the opportunity to do some trials with those 10 clients.
Did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it. And it was sort of like, I felt like I was Amazon woman helping these people, because they were mostly poor, uneducated people who, you know, just had no clue how to present a case for themselves. And in fact, one moment I'll never forget was I had a client on the stand, and, you know, we'd been taught to go over, it was sort of like the champagne of public defense to have the school students, because we had supervisors watching what we did, and we spent a lot of time on each case where real public defenders didn't have time for all that. But I thought I was pretty well prepared, and I asked this defendant, state your name and spell it for the record. You know, that was the first question, and he couldn't spell his own name.
Oh.
And it was just a shocking moment for everybody in the courtroom. And then everyone sort of realized a little bit more about who he was and why he'd gotten into this predicament that he was in. But it was sort of, law school changes you, and those experiences of working with people who are sort of helpless in legal system also changes you, just as you're saying. But let's get back to your legal thriller. So at some point you decided you were going to pursue your interest in writing. And was that more politically motivated than the fact that you wanted to write? Because it sounds like originally you wanted to act.
Originally I wanted to act, but by the time I left the corporate world, I had already started writing a book. So I've all my life been an avid reader and started writing when I was in middle school. But there may be a copy of that buried in my mother's attic. I'm not sure. So the allure of telling stories and being able to touch people through your stories, that's a very powerful incentive for me.
Well, it's interesting because you've written a legal thriller, and I've read it. It was really a page-turner. I never stopped to think, oh, she's trying to teach me something. But I know that you were trying to convey information to people. You weren't just trying to entertain people. And I'm curious what you did to not make this preachy.
Mm. Well, I tried to make it a story of growth. Certainly I am trying to convey information about sexual harassment and discrimination, and my goal was to do that in an entertaining way. But I guess I studied writing long enough to have an appreciation that you have to have a character arc. And in creating my protagonist's character arc, I guess I came up with another topic that I'm preaching about, which is ambition. As you know from having read the book, the protagonist comes to realize the cost of ambition. And by the time I had left practicing law in the corporate world, I had come to see the cost of ambition.
Interesting. Yeah. I was curious about one thing. So you have a very beautiful protagonist, mm-hmm. and I was wondering, did you have any second thoughts about making her a gorgeous attorney?
That's an interesting question. One of the things that I did deliberately was create the character Sunny Star Perez, who is perhaps the person who is most damaged by sexual harassment. And Sunny isn't gorgeous. And she was deliberately made to not be gorgeous, to show that even people, men and women, who aren't physically attractive are subject to harassment.
That's interesting. I also, just along those lines of physical things, I was so intrigued to discover that you had all these Pinterest boards related to the book. I've never seen that before. And so on Pinterest, first I wanted to remind listeners, you're listening to Writers' Voices on Crew FM 100.1. I'm Cheryl Fusco Johnson. I have a fascinating guest today. It's Kate McGinnis. Previously, she practiced as an attorney in a pretty high finance corporate world and then decided that she wanted to write fiction and use that fiction to help educate people about women's issues, although sexual harassment is not strictly a women's issue. But one of the things that you're doing to advertise your book is you created these Pinterest boards. And so if people are interested, they could go to Pinterest and then go to Kate McGinnis. And then you'll find boards of what your main character, Maggie, wore, the kind of furniture she had in her house. And I think there's also setting, things that help explain the setting. How did you come up with the idea to do that?
Well, I started hearing about Pinterest in January, and I guess I'm a very visual person. So the idea of being able to help readers visualize what was going on in Terminal Ambition. I mean, I realize that it is set in a world that few people experience. Part of my motivation for picking that world and picking the character and her client is that I spent years financing huge leverage buyouts that were done by Kravis, Kohlberg, and Roberts. And Henry Kravis is and was certainly a favorite of the society pages in the New York Times. His second wife was a fashion designer. So to some extent, that world and the world of Henry's lawyers, which I knew, I was on the other side of the desk for them, were worlds that I got a peek into. And it is really quite an extraordinary world, I guess, as now all of us are getting a peek into as we learn about Bain Capital, which was essentially a leveraged buyout firm. And we see Ann Romney and Rafalka at the Olympics, that, you know, there is an entirely different world that other people live in who have privilege.
Fascinating. I have to admit that at one point you were describing these chairs in your book that your main character's husband preferred. And so he had filled the house with these chairs, and people were always discussing how uncomfortable they were, but, you know, they were objects of art. I couldn't picture it at all. And then when I went to the Pinterest board, I could see they were really lovely chairs, but they might not be particularly comfortable. So it's a different way to experience fiction, and that's part of being essentially you're a self-published author, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
So you had a lot of ladders to climb, because you not only were going from corporate legalese to prose that's going to be popular with lots of people, because you want a lot of people to read your book and become educated about these issues that intrigue you, but you also had to learn how to get your book out there for people to read. So what was the first step you took to think about how you were going to get your book in the hands of readers?
Well, I was fortunate to have been reading for several years Nathan Bransford, who has a blog, and he was himself for a number of years a literary agent, and he was very generous in sharing advice with readers about everything, I'm sorry, with would-be writers, readers of his blog, about everything from query letters to how many words should be in your novel, does it depend on what genre you're writing in. I mean, just, he's a real resource. And I happened to read Nathan's advice that if you're going to publish a book, you need to establish a presence on social media a year in advance of publication.
Oh, interesting. So a year before you finished the book?
Well, I had finished the book in the spring of 2011, and I went through the frustrating process once again of submitting it to agents and had requests for fulls. But the traditional publishing business is not in great financial shape, and it never went forward. I never got picked up by an agent, and I then had to consider, well, do I keep beating my head against this wall of trying to find an agent who then has to beat his or her head against a wall to find a publisher, or do I join this tide of authors who are self-published? And once I realized that from the time a publisher accepts your manuscript, it'll be 2 years until it's published.
Yeah, that's all right when you're 30.
Exactly. Exactly. At my age, I thought, I'm going to go for it, do it on my own, and hopefully get this knowledge out there to help some women.
Has that been an exhilarating process? Because people, I would say we're probably close to the same age, and people of our generation don't always have as much facility with social media as like people who were born into the world where it existed. So have you been frustrated by it, or have you been exhilarated by it, or how's that process been for you?
I have been exhilarated every time I overcome a hurdle. Once I feel that I have gained mastery on one of the channels of social media, it's like, oh, that's not so bad. And now on to the next. So I started with Twitter, and that was, I consider Twitter to be quite fun, and it also lets me pander to my interest in current events. I'm somebody who could just keep reading different news sites and blogs most of the day. And so now I continue to do that, but I realize, well, this is fodder for my Twitter feed, or this is something I can post about on Facebook. So there's a little rationalization of feeding my addiction to the news about creating content for the
but
different media sites.
But that is also building what they call a platform. Now, even the traditional publishers want authors to have a platform, and what that is a network of people that they can reach through online media.
Exactly. I mean, there were some agents that I considered querying who wanted to know, well, how many Twitter followers do you have? How many Facebook followers do you have? And I thought, well, wait a minute. If I'm going to a traditional publisher, don't they provide the marketing? And, of course, it turns out that that is sadly falling off. Traditional publishers don't do too much to help authors with marketing.
Often, too, what's the case with traditional publishers is they take a few stars and they put all the energy into those people, and then they have some other authors that are also there, but they're not given quite that white glove treatment, and so they have to kind of sink or swim on their own. So it does seem that most authors who are writing today feel that they have a lot of responsibility for marketing as well. If people wanted to find you on Twitter, how would they do that?
Well, you've asked about social media. I would tell you that I just had a consultation with Phyllis Carr, who's our local Fairfield expert on social media. And Phyllis told me quite firmly I needed to change my Twitter handle, which is an abbreviated version, because Twitter only gives you so many characters, of Women's Rights Writer. That's the name of my personal website. But you can find me on Twitter if you search for Kate McGinnis. And my last name, I tell people my dad picked the most complicated way. It's spelled like Guinness Stout or the Guinness Book of Records. So it's McGinnis. So you can find me that way on Twitter or Facebook or Pinterest, and also LinkedIn.
Well, that's great. So we have had Phyllis on the program, and she is a wonderful resource to have here in Fairfield. And I noticed that as you were going down this path of self-publishing, you built a team for yourself. And I noticed that you had an editor that you worked with.
Yes.
And also, there's an editor. Cover designs. There's someone who designed the cover.
Yes.
So how did you decide who would be good? Like, did you get recommendations, or did you look at this Nathan Bransford for tips on how to pick an editor and how to pick someone to do your cover?
Well, actually, I have a very dear friend in California, Sandy Nathan, who is self-published. And Sandy has published maybe 6 books by now. Sandy writes in the category of visionary fiction, fantasy. So Sandy, having been down this path and having found people and rejected them, and Sandy was very kind in sharing her resources with me. And the man who did my cover is Louis Agrell of Agrell Group, A-G-R-E-L-L. And Louis has done covers for Sandy. And the single person who I would say was most instrumental in shaping this book into a form that it is now, as you say, a page-turner, was Melanie Rigney, R-I-G-N-E-Y. And she can be found at editor4u.com. And Melanie served for 5 years as an editor at Writer's Digest. And she is just marvelous. One of the problems I had with an earlier version of Terminal Ambition that Melanie looked at was I had worked with another editor for hire who was recommended by a literary agent. And I'm afraid I took a lot of wrong roads.
Oh.
So by the time I got to Melanie, the novel was twice as long as it is now, and there were many more subplots, and I knew that it needed to be pruned pretty seriously.
So how did you find another editor to help you?
Well, Melanie was recommended by my friend Sandy Nathan.
Okay, so that brings me to another question. Do you belong to any associations, like writers' associations, like Sisters in Crime or Mystery Writers of America? Or is there a specific organization for people who are going to do self-publishing?
You know, I don't. And maybe that's, I should, as I'm building my social network, go look into that. I will say one of my writing instructors at UCLA, Claire Carmichael, who blurbed the book, was actually the former president of Sisters in Crime. And I did try reaching out to Sarah Paretsky, who was the founder of Sisters in Crime, hoping that I could get a blurb from her. But I didn't get a response. You have to develop a very thick hide in this process. And I have to say, I've been fortunate in that the people who have responded, I have never gotten a negative response. But there are people who simply don't respond.
They might be so busy and not know you.
Right. Know, so you just have to learn it's not about you.
Right.
It's about what's going on in their life and what their priorities are.
Yeah, you just never know what's happening with people.
Right.
So would you explain a little about the importance of a blurb and what you mean by a blurb?
Sure. What I mean by a blurb are the quotations that you would see on the cover of a book. Often they're on the rear jacket, rear cover. And hopefully the person who picks up the book and sees the blurb will be tempted to read it. Also, the blurbs appear on my page on Amazon.com as praise for the book. And I have been just really gratified by the blurbs, the praise that I've gotten.
It is pretty high praise. As you read through the blurbs that you have and the people who are providing you with recommendations of your book, a lot of them are academics who work with issues of discrimination. And I think it really speaks well that you persuaded them, or didn't even have to persuade them, but drew their attention and was able to get all these people to recommend your book. And again, we're talking about Terminal Ambition. It's a legal thriller written by Kate McGinnis.
Thank you. Yeah, I have to say, when I read some of these, I mean, it really brought tears to my eyes after having worked on a book for so long, that people got it. They saw the value of it. You know, when Kathleen Berry, who's a sociology professor, says, you know, this could revolutionize how you think about going to work and what you can do there. That just, I was overwhelmed.
Have you made some appearances, some public appearances yet for this book? When did it come out? I think it's only been like a few months or a month or two?
A few months, yes. It came out in Kindle in the end of May. I haven't yet. Another one of our Fairfield personalities, John Kramer, who you may know, used to be a professor at MUM, and I've had a consultation with him. He is a book marketing guru of the highest order. And
he was really on the forefront. He was helping people with self-publishing back when it seemed that all that existed were vanity presses, you know, where people were actually getting bilked out of money. He was, I think, among that first wave of people that realized self-publishing is a way for people to get their message out. And now that we have more splintered audiences, and, you know, I think self-publishing's time is really arriving. There's the technology for it, and there are different niches of people who want to read different sorts of things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think John was instrumental in launching Deepak Chopra, who has quite a publishing career.
Did he self-publish?
I don't know that he self-published, but think John gave him advice.
Like on marketing and promotion.
And also the Chicken Soup for the Soul series John was involved with. So John's advice to me was, use social media, you know, stay in your office, use social media and work on the sequel to Terminal Ambition.
So how do you do all that? How do you keep up with your social media and still work on your sequel and promote the original book?
That's a very difficult process. The only thing I can say is the training that I had as a lawyer, working 60 hours a week, some weeks 90 hours a week, comes in handy.
I think people might be interested in hearing a little excerpt from your book. So while you're finding your page, I'm just going to remind listeners, this is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. I'm host today on Writer's Voices. My guest is Kate McGinnis, and she's going to read to us from her new book, a legal thriller called Terminal Ambition.
Thank you. The protagonist of Terminal Ambition is a woman named Maggie Mahoney, and she has been the wife of the law firm's managing partner. It is a major international law firm. She works in the headquarters in Manhattan, And because of her relationship with her husband, she's always had quite a privileged existence inside the firm, treated with a fair amount of respect and deference. And after he is no longer in her life. I'm not going to have a spoiler there. I'll just say that once her husband ceases to be in her life, she has found that things are changing. And what I'm going to read now is about a third of the way through the book, as Maggie is beginning to see that the firm isn't the benign meritocracy that she thought it was. Maggie opened her office door and was greeted by the dissonance of three women speaking simultaneously. Her secretary, Jasmine, looked furious. Woody Ferguson's new secretary, Lily Ching, looked teary. And Heather Weaver, another secretary from down the hall, looked embarrassed. "Mind if I join you?" Maggie asked with a grin. "I'm sorry," Jasmine said. "Lily was really upset and we needed to talk to someone. She didn't want Woody to hear, so we came in here. Maybe now you're here, you can tell her what to do." Blinking her dark eyes, Jasmine jammed her glasses up on her nose with two fingers. Her jaws were clenched so tightly, ridges appeared under her mahogany cheeks. Her wiry body seemed to swell with rage. Maggie crossed the carpet to her desk and slipped into her chair. "I'm not sure I can tell her what to do, but I'll certainly try to help." Lily flushed. "No, it's okay. I don't want to make trouble." "Girl, you need to talk to Maggie. She'll get this straightened out," Jasmine said. "Well, maybe." Lily spoke in a high, thin voice. "If it's not inconvenient." "Lily, why don't you have a seat? Jasmine and Heather, I think it's best if you go back to your desks and cover the phones, okay?" Mumbling their agreement, the two women left. Lily perched nervously on the edge of a chair. She was a real beauty, with large oval eyes and long black hair, but her slender body seemed to almost vibrate. Deliberately, she lowered her hands to her lap as if they would anchor her to the chair. Her fingers were wrapped around a long, narrow, velvet-covered box. "So, what's going on?" It's Mr. Ferguson. He called me into his office this morning and told me to shut the door and take a seat. When I did, he came out from behind his desk and gave me this box." As she extended it toward Maggie, it trembled. "He said it was a present to celebrate my working with him for a month." The satin-lined box held a gold chain with a single pearl pendant. The whole thing looked like a fake. A gold-plated chain with a glass blob at the end. Maggie said, I suspect you're not here because of his seeming generosity." "God, no, not at all. I told him I couldn't take it, but he insisted on putting it on me. He lifted up my hair and ran his fingers along my neck." She grimaced. "It really creeped me out." She rubbed the back of her neck with her palm as if to wipe away any trace of him. "I kept saying that I couldn't take it, that I didn't want it, but he wouldn't listen. I stood up and reached behind me to take it off, but he stepped in front of me and..." She swallowed hard. "He ran his hands down the chain and then he put them on my breast." Maggie winced. "That's awful, really disgusting. I'm so sorry." Lily looked down at her hands as they wrestled with each other in her lap. It's not just that. He said that if I took care of him, he'd be a great boss, make sure I got a big raise, let me come in late, take long lunches, whatever I wanted." She lifted her face. "I told him I didn't want any of that. I just want to be a regular secretary, and he could have his damn necklace back." "Good for you. I bet that knocked him back on his heels." "I don't know if it did or not. He said he'd be out of the office until late this afternoon, and I should think it over." She sighed. "I shouldn't have taken the job with him, but I needed the work. I mean, he was weird, even in my interview." "Like what?" "He asked things like if I could get pregnant, if I had any sexual fantasies. Then at the end of the interview, he flexed, you know, his bicep, and asked me to feel his guns." "He is such a jackass," Maggie said, and then paused to figure out the best way to help Lily. Getting emotional wasn't it. "Are you working late tonight?" Lily shook her head vaguely as if she didn't quite understand the question. I wasn't planning on it. I mean, do you need help with something? No, I just wanted to wait until you were gone for the day and then talk to Woody. With your permission, I'll speak to him about his need to treat you with respect. Is that okay with you? You do that for me? I mean, a partner standing up for a secretary? Maggie didn't like the sound of that. Of course I will. Do I have your permission? Yeah, sure, but I don't want to get fired because I complained. I need the work, and the benefits are good, too. With the economy being so crazy, it could be hard to get another job. Don't worry. You won't get fired for talking to me. Mr. Ferguson needs to be educated on appropriate workplace conduct, okay? Standing, Lily managed a small smile. Okay. Maggie lifted the box. Do you want me to give this back to him? For sure. I don't ever want to see it again.
So we know that there are women all over, everywhere, who experience things like that and have no one to turn to where they work. So that's one of the reasons you decided to write this book.
Exactly.
And I was interested in the back matter you had, and the back matter is just the stuff at the end of the book. You had a lot of interesting things. One was a list of questions for book club members. I thought that was kind of cool. And there were also tips for victims of discrimination and harassment. Did you want to share a couple of those tips with listeners?
Sure. And I appreciate your mentioning them because that was another factor that really pushed me towards self-publishing. I had heard from literary agents that, oh no, a traditional publisher wouldn't go along with having this back matter, which is a memorandum from the fictional protagonist to potential clients about how to deal with sexual harassment. And that was very important to me, to include that.
So that was, it was interesting because I haven't seen that in adult books. I'm more, I've been in the world of children's books for many years. And you see that in children's books. There'll be material at the back for parents to use with young children or just to extend the learning. Even if it's a book of fiction, there might be something, if it's historical fiction, say, it's pretty common. But I really don't think I've seen that before in adult fiction.
I saw it first and maybe only in Michael Crichton. If you remember, he and some of his early books would have an appendix setting forth the science for the fiction that was created inside his book.
Interesting. If I had noticed that, I probably had forgotten it. But yeah. So you use the device of your fictional attorney, Maggie, is writing this memorandum, but the material in this appendices is factual, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's this memorandum explains what the law is, and then more importantly, has 12 steps so that if a woman is subject to harassment, there are 12 steps that basically escalate. And the first one, and probably the most important one to share, is to say no clearly. I think so many women are trained to be good girls and not hurt people's feelings. So we would tend, if a fellow asked us for a date, we might say, no, I'm seeing my mother tonight, or I'm visiting my grandmother in the rest home, or I'm going to see a movie with a girlfriend, when we really don't want to see this guy at all. And it's much better to say no. Just no, I'm not interested in having that sort of relationship with you. Because if you make an excuse once and he comes back again, then are you going to be the good girl and spare his feelings and make another excuse? And it sets up a situation where the harassment is easier to occur.
It is. It can be confusing for men, and I think maybe some men who don't intend to be disrespectful may, as you're saying, continue to ask someone not understanding. So that makes sense that the first point is be really clear with what your intentions are.
Yes, absolutely. And another important point of these 12-ish points is if this is a continuing pattern of behavior and there are incidents that you are troubled with, is write them down. start to create a written record, and if there are witnesses to what's going on, ask the witnesses to also create a written record, because that will give you much greater credibility in case if he said, she said comes up.
So did you want to give us a couple other points
as
well?
Sure, absolutely. I would hope that women can work through these situations in their workplace. Hopefully the workplace does have mechanisms in place to resolve this short of litigation, even though you and I are both lawyers. So starting with say no clearly, write down what's going on. If it's still going on, then report the harassment to your supervisor or to the human relations department, whatever authority exists inside your workplace. And then another one that I think is very important is to resist the temptation of talking to others about what has gone on, because that's one of the things women do is share their stories, but they could become subject to a claim of defamation.
Oh, I never thought about that.
Yeah. I mean that.
And then it would be difficult to prove that the event actually happened.
Yeah, exactly. There was a case recently in which a minor was raped by two other minors, and she went through all the correct channels, and I think the rapist received a very light sentence that she was quite frustrated with, and she ended up tweeting their names and what they had done. And
I've read about this case online, and then
right.
She got in trouble for using their names when that had all been, I forget the term for that.
They were minors, and so their identities were protected, it's just one example of how we feel we want to avenge those who have hurt us, avenge our honor, but it can come back to bite you. So be careful about that.
So I thought one of the interesting devices in your book was that you had your character involved in a request by one of the other partners that she be on a gender equity committee, and that makes it look as if, oh yeah, the company is really aware of issues of sexual discrimination. They want to do something about it, so they've created this committee. And in fact, it seemed like it might have just been a cover so that they could identify which women might make complaints and then either fire them or buy off their confidentiality so that they would not talk about it. Do you think that that happens? Because that's sort of a confusing thing.
Yes, I do think that happens. I think it is a technique used by defense lawyers. And I think one thing I would love to see as a matter of public policy change is the use of confidentiality agreements. Because if women are sexually harassed and the employer comes to recognize, yes, this happened, or sexually discriminated against, often the price of redress for the woman is that she'll sign an agreement and the agreement will have a confidentiality clause. And the bad offenders keep sometimes being the bad offenders.
Because nobody is able to publicly say what had happened to them.
Exactly. I mean, there are cases in law, and I'm not sure why law firms and lawyers are particularly egregious in sexual harassment. Maybe it's because they think they know the law and they're such great, brilliant attorneys, they can beat the claims in court. But there are several law firms where a senior partner has been called to account for his treatment of women, and within months of paying off the woman victim, the man is then elevated to a higher position inside the firm.
And then the woman is helpless to say, to make that public where
exactly
this behavior is actually being tolerated.
Right, and reward. I mean, I don't think the firm intentionally means to reward the bad behavior, but certainly by keeping the bad actor at the firm and then promoting him, they are ratifying his conduct And I think that's something that employers should be very wary of, is ratification by continuing the bad actor in the workplace.
That's a good point. So I found that very interesting, the idea that a firm that looks like, you know, they're doing something good is actually secretly maneuvering to expose victims and deal with them privately. So that's kind of interesting. So you did have questions for book clubs. Are you aware of any book clubs that have become aware of your book yet?
Well, there is one in Fairfield. Actually, there are two. And I hope to reach out to book clubs. Actually, I have some resources of book clubs' newsletters that I'm going to try and promote Terminal Ambition in, because I think many book clubs are populated by women.
And I think that's true.
I think this is a book that even if women are our age and don't have these problems anymore, I think women will care about these issues for their daughters or grandchildren or nieces. And they may be shocked to learn what's going on in the workplaces that where their relatives or neighbors are employed.
Have you used Skype at all?
I have used Skype somewhat. My principal use of Skype was when my son was living in Denmark, but I do have an offer and would be very glad to participate in book club discussions via Skype.
So I think that would be really fascinating. I want to remind listeners, you're listening to Crew FM 100.1. I'm Cheryl Fusco Johnson on Writer's Voices with Kate McGinnis, author of Terminal Ambition, which is a legal thriller that helps educate people about issues of sexual harassment and discrimination. And so what do you have in the works next after this book?
The next book is called Erotic Capital. And that is inspired by a nonfiction book that was released, I think about a year ago, by a British sociologist, a woman, who her point is that each of us, men and women, have erotic capital. And she advocates that both sexes take advantage of their erotic capital. There's certainly a lot of studies that show that people who by conventional standards are beautiful or handsome succeed more in the workplace, receive higher pay. So perhaps her premise is correct. One of the things I am trying to pursue in that book, however, is how our culture's notion of erotic capital forces so many women into eating disorders and body dysmorphia. We were talking about my tweeting, and one of the things that I tweet when the news on a slow news day is I tend to tweet feminist quotes. And the quote that has been overwhelmingly successful and repeated in a week, had 128,000 impressions for 2 weeks in a row, was a quote from Naomi Wolf's book, The Beauty Myth. Now I wish I could remember it clearly. But the point is that in a culture obsessed with beauty, embodied by a thin female body, that culture is not truly obsessed with beauty, but with female obedience. Women being obedient to the notion, culture's notion of what beauty is.
Interesting. So it's the idea of you wear the stilettos because it makes you more attractive to men, and that's kind of being obedient to that way of looking.
Right. And it makes you more attractive in the workplace, in omnivorously cruising the net. You wouldn't believe the studies that I find with, you know, women who wear red get bigger tips. Waitresses who wear red, if they wear red lipstick, they do better than if they wear pink lipstick.
And here we are with no lipstick.
Yes.
But fortunately, we're on the radio, so that's nobody knows. Well, that's very interesting. That I thought as you were describing the nonfiction book that you probably were not buying into the notion that everybody should be kind of living their lives to make the most of this erotic capital that we have. Cause that
no, I don't. But I do think that is something that I have succumbed to in my life, that it's hard now as we're sitting facing each other at our age to sort of imagine it. But when I was much younger, I think my looks, my appearance played a role in my success.
That's not hard to imagine at all.
Thank you.
And I think you're making an assumption about what women of our age look like and how we feel about our attractiveness and how other people perceive us.
Well, that's true. That, you know, I'm glad you called me
I have to point that out. But yeah. We grew up in a time, it was confusing. You know, people were all kind of, I remember I worked at a sanitary engineering company, big company, and they, on Secretary's Day, gave out little vials of perfume to every female employee of the company, even the female engineers. The female engineers were very offended to receive these vials of perfume on Secretary's Day, but it's confusing. Like, what does it mean when you wear earrings and lipstick? Maybe you just want to feel happy that day and have some color, you know? So people have to find that middle ground.
Right.
And I think your books are helping people formulate questions and become more educated about these things. I'm curious, have you heard from any former coworkers who have read your book? Are they aware of what you're doing?
Yes, I have heard from several, and you know, I have gotten one or two comments saying, I think I might recognize a person or two in here.
Do you think they might, or do you think, I've heard that that's pretty common where people think they see themselves in a book and it's not actually them at all.
Well, it's funny, along those lines, my son read this. He was one of my proofreaders. My son is 23, and he liked it. I was surprised. And so I said to him, well, which one of the characters do you think is me? And he picked a character that totally surprised me. So I guess you're right. People don't, the people's, readers' visions of who the characters are based on in real life doesn't always comport with what the author's vision is.
Did you have any worries about anybody wanting to sue you for what was in the book?
I did have a little worry about that, particularly about the antagonist. There were two antagonists, but the more senior antagonist and a friend of mine who actually teaches a relevant topic in law school gave me advice that the person who might find himself pictured as the antagonist is now deceased.
Oh.
And deceased people have no right to sue for defamation.
Interesting. I also, as I was reading about you online, it looked like you had some exposure to publishing in your career as an attorney. Did you work for, what exactly were you doing when you were an attorney?
I basically did a lot of very big deals and worked on the documents that made the deal operative, whether it was a merger agreement that pursuant to which two companies married each other. I worked on a merger of a Dillingham company in Hawaii, and when the deal was closed, there was a Hawaiian priest there and at the Outrigger Canoe Club in Oahu, and he did a Polynesian wedding ceremony to marry these two companies.
How interesting. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it was fun. But most of the writing I did was very dry, although I did publish some for attorneys. I wrote in legal periodicals.
That's very demanding writing.
It
that
is.
That kind of writing. So that'd be like law review writing.
Exactly, exactly. But it is, to some extent, promotional for lawyers.
Interesting. I didn't know that the public would become aware of, you know, what was written in legal journals.
Well, you think you're hoping that your clients will. When you have very sophisticated clients, and you can use that in a pitch to clients.
Interesting.
You know, I mean, as I said, I did a lot of leverage buyouts, and I was one of the authors of a seminal piece on leverage buyouts assuaging lenders' concerns in leverage buyouts to be sure that they could collect their debt. And now, ironically, that whole issue is being litigated in the case of the Tribune bankruptcy, you know, the Chicago Tribune, which bought out the public company that I was the general counsel of. And when the Tribune went bankrupt, there went my retirement.
Oh, good thing you're writing.
Exactly.
You better keep up, keep writing those books. So is this going to be a trilogy?
Oh, I'm hoping it'll be more than a trilogy, because I think there are so many issues that are worth exploring. And
such as the issue you just mentioned.
Yeah, women's body image and how that gets culturally dictated.
And also people losing their pensions in these deals where someone is enriched. That money doesn't just disappear, it goes somewhere.
Exactly. And, you know, it went to the shareholders of the Tribune when Sam Zell bought it out.
Our time is almost at an end. We just have a few minutes left. What was it like to work with Janet Fitch, who was the author of White Oleander?
Oh, it was just marvelous. I mean, she was teaching us how to write using the senses. And she is such a master of that. And she gave us so many good exercises about, all right, just write 10 sentences, and each sentence try and evoke a different sense, you know, whether it's... And the purpose of evoking the senses, you know, as the writer, is to give the reader the sense of being present, to make the reader, to enfold the reader in the story.
Right, because fiction isn't like legal writing, which is very cerebral. Fiction has to be sort of visceral and tangible.
Right, so if you can describe one character feels hot because the other character always has his office at 85 degrees, or... when a character feels fear, you know, what happens? Does, you know,
yeah, what's the physical sensation?
Yeah.
You're going to have a book signing soon, right? Do you want to tell us a little about that before we have to close?
Yes, I'm going to be at the Fairfield Public Library on September 19th at 7:30 p.m., and I will be signing copies of Terminal Ambition and also talking about the same issues we've talked about here today and maybe a few more.
Did you say what time?
7:30 on Wednesday night, September 19th.
Do you have any other events lined up?
No, this is it. I'm kind of torn between, I do have readers and followers on Twitter who say, oh, come here and we'll line up an event for you. Torn between that and following John Kramer's advice to focus on social media.
Social media is really important, and you've done, it sounds like, a really good job. You even have like a Kindle Fire contest going. Where would people find out about that?
Yes, if the people go to my website, katemcginnis.com, there's information there about the blog tour, and there is a Kindle Fire that people may win by following the blog tour and posting comments on the tour, and there's also a cash prize.
So you'll want to go to Kate McGinnis's website. It's katemcginnis.com.
Right.
Find out about that and her book, Terminal Ambition. Thank you for being our guest today, Kate.
Thank you very much for having me.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.